New research from Maynooth University's School of Law and Criminology has found a significant year-on-year increase in restorative justice referrals and victim participation in Ireland. That's a process that allows those harmed by a crime and those responsible for that crime to communicate in a safe way. Janet O'Brien's eldest son Luke was killed in an unprovoked one-punch assault in Talla in 2017 on Halloween night. The perpetrator, Jack Hall Ennis, pled guilty to his manslaughter and received a five-year sentence. Janet met the perpetrator and has since been advocating for restorative justice to inmates in Irish prisons. So what is it like to confront your son's killer? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. And Janet, you are very welcome to News Talk Daily today. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you, Ciara.
Let's start by talking about Luke himself, your eldest boy that you were extremely close to. You had a very loving relationship.
Yeah, my face automatically goes into a smile when I, you know, start to think Luke or anyone is chatting about him. Yeah, he was my firstborn. He was the eldest. He was, talk about blue-eyed boy. He was, you know, just sunshine. And yeah, from a young age, he was always quite care and very conscious of other people and, you know, wanting people around him to be in good form. Yeah, he was a grand little kid now, I have to say. Lively. I hated school, all of those things, you know. But, you know, an all-round, you know, kind-hearted soul. Actually, I remember some of his friends giving him the nickname a gentle giant. He was 6'2".
So he was, as you say, the blue-eyed boy, not mommy's favourite, but everybody knows how Irish mommies feel about their sons. But he did go through school, didn't he? He did sit the junior cert, he did sit the leaving cert. You got him to that point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we did. And it was, I think I remember saying to somebody else as well, you know, I really felt that I was also deserving of those certificates. But yeah, you know, he did a tough old time, really. He did suffer with depression. He had lots of allergies. He suffered really, really bad eczema. So God love him, he was always going for appointments and stuff like that. Like, but he was always up for whatever was suggested to him that was going to help, you know, whether it be with his mental health or his skin or his allergies or stuff. You know, he just went with the flow, do you know?
And he was in a good place, wasn't he? He'd gone back college. He was studying. The future was looking good for Luke.
It was. It was. Yeah, when he first left school, he'd had a few little, you know, bits and bobs kind of jobs and shops. And he kind of quickly realised that, you know, that wasn't going to get him very far. Like Luke was, you know, he liked his nice clothes. He wanted the nice stuff. So I could hardly believe it when he was telling me his plan of going back to college, you know, after the years we'd spent in school. But yeah, he set off and he organised himself and he had started an accountancy course in Crumlin College.
Bring me back to that Halloween night, which I do think is a night that makes a lot of parents pretty nervous.
Definitely, definitely. I remember thinking I was in touch with him during the day because he was on his midterm break and we were arranging that we would go to the pictures in Dundrum. I was working in Dean's Grange at the time, so we arranged that he would meet us at Dundrum. I picked up my younger daughter, Ali. She was only 12 at the time. So the three of us met up in Dundrum and went off to the pictures. We went to Eddie Rockets afterwards and, you know, the night was going in nicely. I remember thinking, you know, please God, no, he won't be bothered going out. And I also always think, you know, it's a good indication to the kind of kid he was that he was, you know, that age, 20 years of age and out with his mum and his little sister, do you know, for pictures and, as I said, something to eat. But the phone kept going, you know, the texts kept coming in and the lads were looking for him to go out. So we got home and I knew, you know, after a feed of food, he was kind of lolling in the back of the car. We came in to the house, we all started kind of doing our own thing. And he came back down the stairs then to say, oh, mum, I'm going to head out. I'm going to meet the lads. They're still texting. So I remember trying to say to him, oh, Jesus, now would you not get that, you know, assignment done, you know, while you have the midterm? And it was like he was grinning away at me. So I knew my battle was lost. So thankfully, I just smiled and go on with you, you know, this. And off you went.
Do you know, I can picture that scene so clearly. I can picture a 20-year-old boy with that grin when he knows what his mother's trying to get him to do is stay in. And he knows basically saying is, not a chance tonight, Ma.
Absolutely, that was it, yeah. And then, unfortunately, he went off and we continued about our business. And, you know, I went off to bed. You're kind of at 20. You'd be keeping one ear out all right for him, but I wasn't sitting up. But I was woken up then at 3 o'clock in the morning from a Store Street Garda station, a phone call. They had asked me to make my way to tell a hospital that Luke had been attacked. I remember, you know, obviously just jumping up, getting ready, thinking, oh God, was he in a fight? Just getting myself there. I do remember while getting ready, I think I hadn't left the house. A few of the kids had rang Luke's kind of very good friend there, his mother, because they were obviously afraid to ring me. And she had rang me and she said, it's okay, he's responding. And I was thinking, oh, he must have, you know, got knocked out. Still not registering, you know, even when I got to the hospital, there was loads of his pals there. I actually got to the hospital before Luke. I remember seeing him come in the ambulance, you know, he'd no shirt or anything on. I was met straight away with, you know, two doctors in scrubs, asking what happened. The kids kept telling me that, oh, he got a punch from behind. It was Jack. And I remember thinking at the time, I don't care who's done what. Like, I just need to see him and see. Really thought we were dealing with a black eye or something, do you know? It really wasn't registering with me at that time. And unfortunately, we just spent the rest of the night there in telehospital. You know, they were doing different tests and we were just told that Luke had a massive bleed on the brain and that he would have to go to Beaumont for surgery. I remember being brought into the room again. You know, usually people say like, oh God, it's a bad sign if you're brought into a room. Nothing like that was kind of, I was just so intent on listening to what they were telling me, you know, to not fall apart. I have to kind of listen to get Luke better. I got in touch with my sisters then, you know, I was trying to wait till a reasonable hour to get in touch with family. I asked them, would they meet me at Beaumont? I don't think we left Tala because they were trying to stabilise Luke. So it was about 8 o'clock the following morning. And I remember chatting afterwards to my sisters and they were saying that morning, they were saying to me, like, you were nearly at us. We did not recognise you. And I mean, I see my sisters all the time. Like, I would have only seen them the day previous. So that night in telehospital had just changed me, even outwardly.
That was the fear, I would imagine, and the grief.
Yeah. I mean, we did still have some hope at that point. In Beaumont, we were, in fairness, quite quickly brought in. There was more doctors. They were literally bringing him straight for surgery. We were a couple of hours, you know, waiting for that to see, you know, how successful that was going to be. And again, as I said, we always had a bit of hope. They they did just keep saying, oh, we just have to wait and see, we have to wait and see. And you may imagine the 2 weeks waiting. And unfortunately, I used to ring every morning to see how his night was. And they had, I remember chatting to a girl, she was saying, oh, his pupils aren't reactive. And, you know, I said, should I come in? She said, I'm not telling you to come in, but I'm not telling you not to. So I came straight in. And again, another bloody room to be told that Luke had 24 hours.
Oh, Janet.
Just, yeah. Yeah, 20. I couldn't believe my ears. Like, I remember thinking, well, just do another operation. And and then I think there was two or three doctors before me, and you know, they were almost apologetic then, but they had to ask, you know, could they use his organs? And I remember not hesitating and thinking, yes, you can, because please God. And I keep referring to another mother, and I know the whole family is deeply devastated, but I just kept thinking, oh, please God, let another mother be brought into a room to be told there is hope. Not like us getting this news of there's no hope. Even though Luke was only 20, we obviously never had that conversation. But I knew it would be something he would always want to help.
And Luke did pass away on the 13th of November, just under 2 weeks after that attack. And you got to say your goodbyes.
Yeah. I got to climb into bed beside him and spend a bit of time with him. One of the lovely nurses had suggested, you know, because everybody kind of wanted to see him, and she pulled me aside and she said, do you want to get into bed? He's your baby boy. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I was 6'2". I didn't think he'd so much stuff coming out of him that, and he had to be kept going then for the organ donation. So I knew I wasn't going to get a chance to be with Luke for his last breath. So I climbed in beside him and, you know, he was warm, his heart was still beating. I got to cuddle him and it was the most special thing ever. I'll forever be grateful to that nurse for that time.
How did your life change, Janet, in the days and the weeks after the attack and Luke's death?
Oh, Jesus, it was just, unfortunately, we were kind of thrown straight into, you know, the court then. Obviously, Luke's funeral, I hate saying Luke and a funeral in the same sentence. But you just had to go and do all that. Like, I mean, you know, trying to pick out a coffin for your 20-year-old son has to be one of the worst things you'll ever do. And then, as I said, a year long, I think we were 12 or 13 times in court, which was something that we were totally unfamiliar with. The court process is, like, it's so horrific for victims. They're just not even as much as we had teleguards looking after us so well, and our detective who was looking after the case really did look after us so well, but the court system is just, it's horrific.
And Jack Hall Ennis did plead guilty to manslaughter. He did know Luke. He was sort of part of his wider circle, and he accepted that this was an unprovoked one-punch assault that took his life.
That's right.
I mean, most people, most mothers, I think, their natural instinct after that is to be full of anger or pain or rage at the person who's taken your child's life. But you weren't, Janet.
I know. Do you know, I was so conscious of Sean and Ali and Luke's friends. I was determined that we weren't going to go into this, you know, circle of retaliation. I was terrified the lads would retaliate and get themselves in trouble, you know, maybe land in the same way, or even just, you know, in trouble with the guards, not being able to travel, not being able to do all the things now that Luke is never going to be able to do. And I think that kind of kept me going and kind of led me in. I kept going on that pathway, if that makes sense. Do you know that way? Because I remember, you know, being quite vocal with it to them. And, you know, at Luke's Mass, I remember, you know, mentioning that the only thing that they were to do now was to, you know, really live their best lives and just take Luke in their hearts with them. I didn't want Ali and Sean to see, you know, a bitter, angry mother that, you know, I just think it's, I always think it sounds quite hippy dippy, but not that I'm forgiving anybody or making excuses for anybody's actions, but it was more important for me that Ali and Sean just continued to receive all the love and kindness in the world. You know, that they had to live now without their big brother. And I just thought that was more important than, like, I have had people say to me, oh God, I know what I would have done with him if I got a chance, or I know. And it kind of hurts me because it makes me feel like they think that they love their son more, which isn't the case. Like, I'm lost without Luke, but I just feel this is a better way.
Talk to me about that better way, what that actually involved for you, Janet.
Well, initially, once the court finished, some people had got in touch for, you know, to chat about one punch attacks. And I had kind of tried to highlight that they were more commonplace, like they are actually, there's a frightening figure for how many were taken, how many lives have been taken, even in Ireland alone. And I thought it would be a good idea to do these interviews to raise awareness around that. But I had done a few, and then I remember somebody close to me actually had mentioned that, you know, oh my God, he's doing his time. What more do you want? And, you know, you're hurting that family. Like, and I remember being actually really, really shocked because I was thinking, Jesus, that's not what I'm not trying to demonize Jack. I'm not trying to, certainly not trying to hurt his family anymore than they're already hurting. I mean, nobody sends their son out to do anything like that. So I reached out to Jack's mum and met with her and we chatted, and she totally understood why I was doing what I was doing. So once I had her blessing, I continued on. And then, you know, another few years went by. I realised Jack was going to be coming out of prison shortly. And it just struck me that, like, because Jack was on bail that night, because it was for a violent charge, I remember thinking, Jesus, if he comes out and is kind of Jack the lad again, I think that really would have, I don't think I would have coped with that. I would have found that very, very hard. So I just felt I had to have a chance to ask him to be good, like, and, you know, to come out and, you know, live the best life he could now.
You wanted to get the opportunity to ask Jack Hall-Ennis to change his way, to make sure he led a better life, that he himself would break out of this revolving door of crime that he had found himself in. It wasn't just, though, a case of you going to the prison service and setting up a meeting in the prison with Jack, was it?
No, I initially thought that's what I was doing. I remember ringing the prison service. I think I'd seen too many movies. I was asking, like, for a visit in order. I was saying, I just need a visit in order for Jack Hall. And it was actually a lovely guy, and he was asking me, well, had to explain who I was and why I wanted to see him. And he said, look, it really doesn't work like that. You need to get in touch with the probation service. And, you know, it's a whole process. So I did that. I got in touch. I was given a lovely lady, Anya Morris, to work with. And in actual fact, that was kind of like a 6-month process. Anya used to see me once a month and we'd have an hour long meeting. And she'd done the same with Jack. She was kind of very, you know, she was so, so helpful in making sure that when we did eventually get to that meeting, that it was as successful as a meeting like that can be. I knew she was always had my best interests at heart. I knew she would never have let it go ahead if she thought for 1 minute that it was going to be detrimental to me or cause me any more emotional hurt. So yeah, I remember thinking, Jesus, if I hadn't have done those months, I don't think the meeting, even though I thought I knew what I wanted to do, there was so many things that she thought of. Simple things like who was coming into the room first? Are you going to sit face to face? Do you know, that could have thrown you completely. But I was now armed with all this information and the correct way to go about the, as I said, to make, you know, a meeting like that the most successful it could be.
Talk to me about that moment that you did come face to face with Jack. How are you feeling?
Well, you may imagine my stomach was in knots. I had chose to be in the room first and sitting and settled. Jack came in and like I was just, you know, holding every inch of myself, like bracing myself for this. You know, Jack was, it was clear that he was very remorseful. He actually thanked me for being there. He had said he didn't have the courage to get in touch. He had said, like, you know, as soon as he opened his eyes every morning, like he thought of Luke. So I did feel he was very remorseful. He also said to me that, you know, I expected you to be shouting and roaring at me. And I would have sat here, I would have let you. And again, I was just kind of thinking, well, where's that going to get us? I have something that I want to ask you, and that's why I'm here, you know.
And what did you want to ask him?
I just wanted to, like, I keep saying, like, I think I did actually say to him, like, I know you're not 5 years of age, but please be good when you come out. I remember thinking, like, you have a chance now, like, Luke doesn't. So if I felt if he came out and continued down that road, it was a waste of 2 lives. And I just couldn't bear that, you know. And he was very, I knew, you know, when you know somebody is taking in every word you're saying. And I also had showed him a photograph of Luke in hospital. Because, again, not to hurt him, but I just think that visual was the reality of what he left us with. And I know it wasn't Jack's intention for Luke to lose his life, but it was Jack's action that caused Luke to lose his life.
Did it help you, that process, do you think, Janet? Was it...
People often ask me... you know, this, and when I'm in the prisons talking, oh, it must help you. I mean, I've heard people describing their experience of restorative justice, and they are kind of like, oh, I felt so empowered coming out of there, and I, you know, I took my own life back, and I don't get to do that. I just get to try and hope somebody else's life isn't destroyed. Like, that's all I can do, because our lives aren't going to change now. Do you know? So it's a very hard one to, you know, I didn't walk away. I walked away from it so glad I had the opportunity, so glad that it went as well as it could, so glad that I did go ahead with it. But there's no jubilance in anything anymore. You know, there's not 100%. Obviously, you can smile and laugh and try your best, but I always describe it as like kind of going up both sides of the road. You are trying to go up the road in the right direction, but then there's always something coming, you know, like a birthday or an anniversary or even just a bloody day out. Like, you're constantly battling.
And yet you continue, don't you, to speak to prisoners about the consequences of violence. I know you work with a charity called Release that goes into prisons. What have those conversations taught you, and is this something you would like to see more of here in Ireland?
Yeah, absolutely. It has taught me. I've been doing it a couple of years now. And I have, I suppose I keep going because of the feedback that I get. It does take a lot out of me, you know, because I'm sitting in front of them, I'm telling my story, I'm showing them a picture of Luke as his gorgeous self. I'm also showing them the photograph of, you know, how we were left with Luke. So it's quite emotional each time I do it, but I just feel, again, sorry, as I said, the feedback that I've been getting, you know, is that it is hitting home, and it is making people, you know, think about their victims, think about their family, their own families even. I've had, you know, letters, cards, paintings, little plaques. Like, it does make them think, look, I can't change everybody, but, you know, even if it saves somebody, and, you know, on both sides, saves them and any other family being hurt. Do you know what I mean? Like, that they don't have to, as you said earlier, use prison as a revolving door, like.
What do you hope Luke's legacy is going to be then, Janet? And what keeps you going on the really hard days now?
I just always want Luke to be proud of me. So that's why I keep going. And I suppose I know how I feel without him. So that's what drives me to keep going with the prisoners or anyone else that wants to chat about restorative justice, to, you know, try and start turning things around. Because, and I know a lot of people would be angry about this, but, you know, just throwing longer sentences at people isn't really the answer, I don't think. I mean, what did it matter to me whether Jack was in a room for 20 years or 5 years? You know, it still wasn't going to bring Luke back. And would Jack have come out then at 20 years, like, so bloody angry and so? Whereas now, my hope is that I'm, you know, hopefully I have gotten through to him. Hopefully he has. I've never heard anything of how Jack is now or what he's doing. I like to think that that's because there's nothing to hear. So, yeah, every day is just about making Luke proud.
I think he'd be incredibly proud. If he heard you speaking today, Janet, thank you so much for taking the time to share your story and your bravery with us here on News Talk Daily. And I wish you well.
Thank you.
Well, that's it from the podcast for today. You can listen back to every episode of News Talk Daily on the Go Loud player. For now, from me, Ciara Doherty, take care. Bye-bye.